Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the best of the More Than Just Code podcast.
How you doing?
How's it going?
How's it going?
You gonna do the intro?
Go ahead, break the intro.
Are we ready?
Yeah. Yeah, this is episode 110, by the way.
Why not? Are we recording already? You're rolling?
Right. 30 minutes on the clock.
30 minutes? Okay.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this special live episode of the More Than Just Roundabout Creative Chaos Release Notes podcast, number 110. We're here live in Nashville, Tennessee at Indie Dev Stock, and we thought with all these podcasters in the house, we should all get together and record. So we've got from Release Notes, we have Joe Chaplinsky.
Hello.
And from More Than Just Code, we've got Tim Mitra.
Hey.
And Jaime Lopez Jr.
How's it going?
And from Roundabout Creative Chaos and Miss Indie Dev Stock, Ms. Indie Dev Stock herself, Tammy Corrin.
You have to share the mic, Greg. Hi, guy.
Thought we'd start with a code question, because you know how much I love the code. So we did get a Ask MTJC from Alicia R. Tweets, and she wants to know, maybe we can start with Joe here. Do you ever look back at the code in your old apps and cringe?
Yeah, every day.
Good answer. And would you recode them, or if it ain't broke, ...
Oh, that's a great question. I've done both. I've regretted going in and changing something that wasn't broke. It really depends on how much I want to work with that app in the future and how much I think that this particular section of the app is going to need to be revamped anyway down the line. But in many cases, right now I'm actually avoiding doing an update to one of my apps, my aspect ratio calculator, because I'm afraid, like, it was my first app, and I'm afraid that if I open it up and add this tiny little feature that I want to add, I'm going to be tempted to do 17,000 other things, and 6 months will go by, and that whole thing. So I've been avoiding the update as a result. So
see, I can't do that. When I see it, I have to spend that 6 months to update it, and then I get nothing done. So I don't. How are you resisting that temptation? I mean, is it just because you're sitting there and thinking, look, I don't have 6 months to put in it to do it, and you're disciplined enough to do that, or are you lying to us and you really, like, secretly going away for 6 months, doing it and coming back?
I have the discipline to not do it. I don't have the discipline to open the file and then not do it. So I just don't open the file. Like once I go in there, I'm out of it. I know I can't do it.
The proverbial stick your head in the code sand. Okay, gotcha.
Exactly.
Yeah, I take a different approach. I'll look at apps when a new version of Xcode comes out. I'll see how many warnings there are, and then I'll decide whether I'm going to step away from the keyboard or not. But generally speaking, I do keep my apps, try to keep my apps up to date with new features and things like that. And I have a couple of major apps that I'm maintaining that are written in an ancient language called Objective-C. So we only fix things if we really, really, really have to. So, like the customer loading up Calendar on Xcode 10 yesterday. Or iOS 10, sorry.
Yeah, so I think I took a little bit of a different
flavor from the questions. I interpreted it as like, you know, we had some folks talk about the like the imposter syndrome thing, right? And like, do you ever look back and be like, oh no, like I was a little baby and I didn't know what I was doing there. And I have that feeling with Coda written like literally 3 weeks ago, let us say. This was not great, but yeah. Like, but it got the job done, right? So the second part, would you recode them or if it ain't broke? It's like, well, maybe, or it depends, right? So I've been working in the startup world for a while now, and a lot of times like, oh, the company may not be around for us to even care about this. So no, don't fix it if it ain't broke.
And when you're writing the code, I kind of touched on this in the workshop just before. Are there times when you're sitting there and you're, any of you really, you're writing the code and you have this thing, whatever that thing is, this function that needs to happen, and you're trying to get this to work, and you've basically regurgitated all this code. You threw it up out onto Xcode. It looks horrible. It kind of works enough. Do you go back and fix it like almost immediately, or how long do you let it sit there and fester and grow into this mess that you open it up, you know, 3 days later and go, oh gosh, what was I thinking?
I use multiple undos all the time. I'll build something. If I don't save it as a branch, I just back away, like I said before. So before we dig in, do we have any Ask MTJC, Jaime?
We do. We have one that's sort of related to a fact check. Maybe you should read the fact check, and then we'll read the Ask MTJC.
Oh, this is the one from that Tim Mitra guy, or the MTJC guy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, we were talking last week about, I mentioned that I was under the impression that the original command key symbol, which looks like a quadruple infinity symbol or something like that, was originally derived from a castle that's seen from above, like square box with four turrets. And in the video that was attached to the article we had last week, which I did watch, even though the author said it was purely coincidental, Susan Kerr did say that she had found the original symbol in a book of symbols, which turned out to be a Swedish symbol to represent a point of interest, and it was actually derived from a castle. So in my tweet here, you'll see, if you go look on Twitter, there is the slide that she posted of the original symbol that she used for point of interest, and then she another slide was a direction sign to a campground or something like that in Sweden that she found, which used the same symbol, and then of course a castle, which, you know, looks exactly like the symbol from above as well. So when the comment in the article about Steve Jobs saying you guys are using apples way too much was not in reference to this particular use of Apple on the Apple key, because Jaime's second question, which I guess I'm kind of skipping ahead to, is that when did the Apple key disappear from the command key, which we now call it, right? And he was talking about the menus, because in the original menu they had keyboard shortcuts, and they represented them by the Apple key in a letter, like, you know, X, V, C for, you know, cut, copy, and paste. Not necessarily in that order, but so he was complaining, so they took the Apple key off, and that's when she came up with this, you know, double infinity square point of interest icon that we all know and love on our command keys today. So that was that. And what was in the actual tweet there, Jaime?
So we have one from Weihan. Says, at Tim Mitra, at Div with a Hair, in the Layers 2015 video, Susan Kerr did say she was told by someone that the command symbol actually was the representation of a castle seen from above. Not a coincidence that it looked like a castle. And a link to the Susan Kerr, John Gruber, Layers 2015 conference talk.
Right. And I didn't add my tweet that I posted for you, where I went and actually got all of my keyboards and went through them all and laid them on the ground, on the floor here behind me, and took a picture of them to show when the Apple key, actually the original key, command key on the original keyboard does not have an Apple on it. It just has the infinity symbol, you know, the small key in the center of the image, and all the other keys do up until the keyboard that I have attached to my monitor right now, which was built in 2007. I haven't dug through my laptops, but I figure it's probably around the same time that they removed the Apple key. So 2007 is our, and actually I found a link on the Wikipedia that backed that up as well. Thanks, Wehan, for your contribution in defense of my comments. So, oh, so Greg, I'm just reading your Ask MTJC here that you posted, saying that you mix up the order and say Mark's name first. Do you do that?
That's right. Check the tape. I said hashtag check the tape.
Oh.
I didn't actually go back and look, but I know I have mixed up the order the handful of times where I've taken over the show.
Right. Well, there you go. So
we'll get some overcast links or fireside links. I've discovered you can link directly to a point in time as well. So I'll dig up some links.
Sure. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
All right. What do we got here? First of all, we have a bit of an ask MTJC. Who's going to do this one? You or me, Jaime?
Let's see. I guess I'll do it. So, which is funny. So this one is us saying we're taking the week off because there is literally nothing to talk about. So I was out last week and there wasn't much news. I think we just sort of took a little hiatus, a little brief vacation for that 1 week.
Well, actually, to be honest with you, my post was actually completely sarcastic because we had decided to take the week off, but then there was a story about the notch, right? In the notch that's the horrible thing in the iPhone X is now appearing on several manufacturers of Android devices, right? In fact, I think in the posts I've got here, there's at least four of them. Where is it?
Right. I think Mobile World Congress was probably happening around this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that what it is? Yeah. So, you know, and it's like, let's see, Asus has a Zenfone that has two models of Zenfone that have a notch in them, and Ligu S9 has a notch, and of course Noa N10. I don't know who that's by. Sounds like Nokia, but it's not, I guess. And that Highway one you guys mentioned last week, they have a P20 that apparently has it. And you were saying today that Android P just dropped today?
Yes, as of today, which is we're recording here on Wednesday, March 7th, Android P, the developer preview, came out today, and it officially supports within the operating system the concept of a notch and dealing with things, kind of similar to the way that it roughly works in iOS to handle the iPhone X's notch, as an example. But I think very critically, you know, Tim, you brought up these other phones. These other phones are hilarious because they're not running on Android P developer preview. And so like you can see their UI elements getting cut off by the notch itself.
Right. Yeah. Oh, we mean like battery warnings or whatever?
Yeah, and like clock that. And other things. I think the clock moved sides or something. I'm not an Android user, so I don't know.
But I mean, it's like the difference between an iPhone X layout and an iPhone 8 layout, where like we have things missing behind there, you mean?
Sure. Like that sort of thing. Like if you hadn't updated your app to be compatible with the safe area layout.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hilarious that I like the title in this one. It's bonus notches. But that, you know, for all the bashing we took for months about this notch is non-existent. I mean, the notch that you and I and Mark, none of us look at, you know, we look at it occasionally. It's funny though. I shouldn't say I don't look at the notch, because as I'm walking around and I see other people on their phones, if I see a notch, I know it's an iPhone X. Like my brain just goes, oh, look, iPhone X. And then same thing if the camera orientation is vertical instead of horizontal, I immediately notice that it's a 10, right? So until everybody else starts copying them, then you'll never know again, right? You'll have to take a closer look. But I just think it's funny that the fact that we decided to take a week off when there was nothing to talk about, and it literally is nothing is the notch. That's my joke.
It's also kind of funny, like they're talking to these manufacturers, hey, why do you have this notch? Like, oh, we wanted to make our device look distinctive, which is what?
You mean distinctively
like the iPhone? Is that perhaps you did not finish the quote there? The other thing is that, I mean, I'm probably an apologist on this, where I think of it not as a notch, but as extra ears that give me more real estate, right? Like, not in every case, but in a lot of cases, like, you know, looking at photos or something. But at the very least, there is like a logical reason why that notch is there, right? It's predominantly because of Face ID's technology and how that works. These other devices, at least the ones that I saw and so far, they don't have Face ID, so their notch is actually bigger than it needs to be, just so it can look more like the iPhone X's notch rather than the smaller notch / widow's peak that the Essential phone had, the one that launched a couple months before the iPhone X.
And you don't think they're looking at that, what's that called, True Image camera that uses for the infrared? You don't think they're planning on having that in the phone?
I mean, maybe eventually at some point, you know, when Face ID technology, you know, or the rough equivalent, becomes available to other manufacturers, similar to the way that Touch ID sort of made its way eventually, you know, some rough competitor on the Samsung and Android side. But today, you know, as those devices are being released, like, they're just bigger for no reason. Like, you could make it a lot smaller because you would only need the camera and the proximity sensor and probably the microphone or the speaker part that you're listening to the audio out of, you know, when making a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is very clear that they're doing this just so they can ape the iPhone's style in that sense. And I'm guessing Google sort of had like no choice but to help support those. Otherwise, their platform would end up with, you know, oh man, this Android thing sucks. Look, I can't even see half the damn content at the top here. Like, Google doesn't want that, right? So I think the path of least resistance for them is to support the notch area with a, you know, a more sensible operating system layout and doing whatever the equivalent of safe area layout is for their operating system.
Yeah, it's funny. And by the way, a real-time follow-up, it's true depth camera, which projects and reads over 30,000 infrared dots to form a depth map of your face, plus a 2D image.
The ironic thing about the notch is that there's all sorts of rumors already that the next generation of the iPhone 10 or whatever it's called is going to have a smaller notch, if it even is there at all. They might get rid of it.
Yeah, I heard that too today. So, yeah, I'm surprised by that one.
Yeah, so if that happens, we'll have a whole year next year of only Android phones having this notch.
That would be hilarious if it comes to pass that way.
Yeah.
I was reading about that as well, and I was a little skeptical that they could do it, like, in 1 year. Mm-hmm. I mean, kudos if they do, but I was like, well, maybe they'll stick with this relative form factor for 2 years, and then, you know, that second cycle, like, past the S cycle would be the one that would have it. But
so you'll think there'll be an iPhone XS?
Or 10, what did we say, 10 Series 2 was Greg's?
Yeah.
Or 10-2 was mine. I mean, maybe. It depends on whether the iPhone X was really supposed to come out this past year as it did, or if it was semi-delayed from where Apple had intended to come out with it the prior year, which would give it a full 2 years if you're coming up to this next year.
Interesting, yeah. My one pet peeve about the iPhone X compared to like an 8 or a 7 is that, or 6, is that when you pick it up, if you pick it up upside down and the notch is facing down, it will not wake up, right? You can't, like, you know, you have to flip it over to what it considers its proper orientation. Have you guys noticed that?
What if you're standing on your head?
What if you're standing on your head? Good point, Mark. Good point. But would the face ID recognize you if you're standing on your head too? Yeah, that's the other question.
That's why it might work.
Yeah. Mm. Tim, I've had that one happen not too frequently. I think the one that's more frequent to me, because I need to be a better person, to be quite honest, I'm too connected, is that I'll wake up and then, like, the first thing I do is look at my phone and see what I've missed, you know, because I wake up kind of later.
Way.
And, like, my squinty eyes and I'm, like, still adjusting to being in the conscious world means that sometimes the Face ID fails.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, as far as I know, it doesn't.
Face ID fails if I'm yawning, or if I'm putting a Pop-Tart in my mouth or something at the time that I'm trying to wake it up. I find it fails that way. But generally speaking, it's pretty good, right? So, and as we talked about before, it actually does update, you know, if it fails and then you enter your passcode, it updates the image with whatever your current state of being is, right? Yeah. Conscious or not.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the big news today, or I guess relatively big news today, was actually not today, but 3 days ago, 4 days ago, that it's the 10th anniversary of the iPhone SDK launch from Apple, right? A post here I've got linked by Craig Hockenberry talks about Icon Factory and some of the early apps that I remember. I don't know if you remember this, if you've seen this, the site, but there's like a screenshot of a guy in a black shirt introducing the iPhone SDK. I remember watching that video and thinking, yeah, that's cool. Went and downloaded it and so on and so forth. But and they go through their history of some of the earlier apps that were created back then, you know, early shots from C4, which I think was one of the first conferences for iPhone development, and talking about, you know, how we had to jailbreak our phones and get into the Unix kernel and before the SDK came along, sort of a little bit of walk down history lane, is that right?
Yeah, walk down history lane.
Okay, thanks. So Mark, when did you first get into iPhone development,
late 2008.
Oh, so you were there, like, on the first little while anyway?
I didn't publish anything that quickly, but I started working on it in 2008, and I think I published something mid-2009.
Yeah.
My first app, I think.
Had you done much Objective-C at that point, or?
No, I hadn't done really much at all. I was doing Python stuff back then.
Right.
And so I had to learn Objective-C. I had dabbled in Objective-C a little bit, because I've always had Macs, you know, and dabbled with doing some OS X or whatever it was development, but not a whole lot. So I had to teach myself.
Yeah, I really don't remember when I started working with this. I'm just going to log on to my other computer, see if I can figure it out. Mm-hmm. Let's see.
Yeah, I was kind of late to the party. I wouldn't start using the SDK until I think it was July of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was definitely a transition period where a lot of the examples were pre-ARC, but ARC had just been announced at WWDC like a month prior.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I have still some.
You never experienced all the joys of retain and release and auto release?
Yeah.
Not in any real serious way. I mean, certainly my own, you know, stuff I was writing was all ARC related, but in terms of professional stuff, there was just some other, like, existing code over, like, a couple of jobs I did while I was a consultant. And even then, a lot of it was like, well, we don't need these anymore. Just delete this stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
It looks like I have, let's see. So I have some stuff from 2009. Oh, 2008. Oh, no, it's PDF. Pacific Connect family. Some hybrid apps from back then. Whoa, that's old. Oh, I actually have an, I guess it must have been like, what was it called? It was PhoneGap originally, right? The hybrid version where you'd write it in JavaScript and HTML.
Yeah, that was, yeah. You did some PhoneGap stuff too?
When I first, got into it, I had a book on how to write, it was like a book on, I think Jonathan, somebody or other, wrote a book on how to write apps using, you know, that kind of technology, right? So I have an image picker app here from 2010. Yeah, I can't remember when the first time, what first app I wrote, install Quick Dynamic. There's a framework here from 2009 as well. Oldie but goodie. And my first tab bar with a view controller. Yeah. We're still working out how to do the two for couples apps back in the early, early days. Yeah. Oh, there's a folder here called Ruben. I wonder what's in there. That's from 2014, though.
I remember my first impression. So given the context that I was doing web development, kind of before it was cool again, I guess. It was like in that lull of like, it got real cool going into the first dot-com boom and then got kind of less cool in the bust. And I remember thinking, wow, like this iOS thing, like it gives you a lot of stuff like out of the box. So I'm looking at this photo in the article here. They have the caption says the first iPhone app created outside of Apple. And it's like, oh man, you get this like really nice look, professional looking UI, like without having to do anything. And that definitely was not true for web development in those days.
No, that's true.
Things have sort of changed now where I'm shaking my fist at Apple being like, hey, well, why don't you give us more out of the box? Like, look at all these web guys. You basically just like import one thing and you got a website and it all looks professionally well done and it's built on a grid layout and everything looks great and swell. And here I am busting my chops trying to figure out how to get this, you know, safe layout thing to work or make sure my fonts like are dynamically resizable and that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. I also had to write, I also did a bit of dash code back in those early days. So like I was given a dash code book to write a review for. So I was doing that, some of that stuff too, back in the early days too. Like making and it would basically create a dash code app that would read your website and, you know, basically show it on the phone. Scary stuff. Mm-hmm. Lots of table views and things like that back in the day too. When did a table view controller come out on iOS or iPhone? Do you remember, Mark?
Oh, that was there from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the early days, pretty much every app was a table view. Table view inside a navigation controller. Some variation on
right,
that.
Right. Well, yeah, there were tab bar apps back then too, right? So.
Yeah, there were tab bar apps. It's true.
Remember the iTunes app was a tab bar app, if I'm not mistaken?
I can't remember.
Or maybe probably a combination of two, I guess.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember when the iPad first came out, the Holy Grail was the split view controller. Mm-hmm. There were lots of different ways to do that.
Right.
I was doing things with view controllers embedded inside other view controllers even back then. It was kind of frowned upon, but I was dabbling with that stuff. It was limited in what you could do. You couldn't do all the stuff that you can do now with the nice container view controller concept that they've got, and, you know, the add child controller and all that kind of stuff. So you really had to hack all the rotation and stuff like that. Yeah. But you could do it.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of the container view controller stuff, and it's definitely nicer than it was before they like really had support for it. I'm hoping at WWDC coming up in a few months here, I hope they'll make it a little bit easier. Maybe not easier to do because not that difficult to do. It's more like it's really easy to mess up, which, spoilers, I always do.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you do it with storyboards, though, it's really pretty trivial now. You just use a container view and just embed your other view controller inside of it, and there's no step three.
So it handles all the add child, remove child stuff.
You don't do any of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the storyboard handles all that for you. If you're not doing that, I would claim you're doing it wrong. Sorry.
That's probably true.
But it was designed for exactly that purpose. So, you know, you're trying to run with a ball and chain around your foot if you're not using storyboards for that kind of thing.
Right. I remember, what year was this? This is probably 2012-ish. I distinctly remember an interview where they'd asked me, you know, how many view controllers can you have on the screen at once? And mm-hmm. I was just a wee baby iOS developer. So I was like, I don't know, like one. I'm like, well, you'd have your, you know, potentially your tab view controller and you're also your navigation controller. I was like, okay. I guess I think of those more of like the Chrome, but sure. Like, I get it.
Yeah.
And now that question would be completely meaningless. Like, I don't know, until I run out of memory. You know, can't address how many little tiny container view controllers are on screen.
Yeah, well, there was definitely a shift in the, you know, the official line from Apple on how to handle that. I mean, at the beginning, it really was one view controller, one screen. I mean, yes, there were like the containers, like the tab bar and the navigation controller, but those were provided by Apple, and those were the only ones you were supposed to do that with. But the rule of thumb really was one content view controller per screen at the time, and it made sense because in the early days, Tim, I don't know if you remember the first couple of phones, especially like the iPhone 3, mm-hmm. was really low on memory.
Yeah, well, so, the first phone so had 100 right. 128 megs, and it was only you can only use about 40 or 50 of it.
Right, right. So if you tried to do a fancy view hierarchy, you were really kind of asking trouble because you were just going to run out of space. But that changed. I don't actually remember when that changed. Probably around the time the iPad came out, because with the iPad you were kind of encouraged to have multiple content view controllers per screen. So it was probably around then that the official line changed to it's okay to have multiple view controllers on one screen. Do you remember when that was, Tim? I don't know.
What was that?
Well, so remember in the early days, there was this very strong official line that said you should have one content view controller per screen.
Right, period. Yeah.
And then that changed. And I guess, now that I think about it, it probably was when storyboards came out, because from the beginning with storyboards, there was the concept of the container view available in the storyboard
right. That
you could use to embed, and embed segues were available right from the get-go with storyboards.
Well, actually, no, the collection view I'm thinking of. No, remember the Stocks app used to have like it had a table view on top and then it had a sliding view on the bottom, like how the Stock app is now. It's been like that since the very beginning, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, but that was probably a scroll view inside a view controller.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably a single view controller at the time.
I have an iPhone 1 right over there. I could go fire it up and see. I still have my original Gorilla Silverback.
Yeah. When did storyboards come out? Was that iOS
5? I think 5.
So that makes sense. Right. That makes sense. Yeah, because with iOS 4...
4 was the rebuild because 3 was horrible.
iOS 4 was... Yeah, not Xcode 4, but iOS 4 was the first iPad. And remember, there were two different versions of iOS 4 for a while?
Yeah.
There was the iPhone version of iOS 4, and there was the iPad version of iOS 4, and they were not compatible with each other?
No, I think... By the way, I think 3.5 was the first iPad OS. Pretty sure. Let me just check.
Sure.
Yeah, I started on iPhone 3 for sure iOS 3 when I first started doing this stuff.
But had the iPad come out?
Yeah. I started on the iPad. I didn't start on the iPhone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I maybe remember wrong. But I vaguely remember there being a iOS 4.1, which was the iPad version, and a 4.2 or something like that, which was the iPhone version. And they eventually got merged. But for a while there were actually two completely different versions that, as I said, they were not compatible with each other. Mm-hmm. And it was explicitly obvious with the popover view, which was only available on the iPad. And so if you tried to compile a popover for using the iPhone version of iOS 4, it wouldn't even compile at the time. It was kind of crazy. But they eventually merged them together. So it makes sense that after all that new stuff came out for the iPad, that it would make sense that an iOS 5 is when they had storyboards that kind of started to bring it back all together.
Yeah. By the way, I think you're right about the iPhone, because it was iPhone 3 was the OS, or iPhone OS 3, and it was iOS 4 was the first when they changed the name.
Yeah.
So introduced in 2010, which about the time the iPad was announced in February, came out in April 3rd, which is my sister's birthday, 2010.
Okay. Makes sense.
But I've could have sworn it was like a 3.5 or something like that. I'm looking on Wikipedia here to see if I can figure it out.
Yeah, it is kind of funny to think back that the SDK only came out in 2008 and the iPad came out in 2010, less than 2 years later.
Yeah.
But it seemed like there was all this time that there was the iPhone before there was an iPad.
Yeah, 2 whole years,
and then,
man.
Yeah, with hindsight, it was almost no time.
Yeah, I think it's sort of that difference between having had a decade versus it was a couple years and then this other thing that's been around for days. Mm-hmm. Because that's why it just sticks in my memory as well. I was like, oh yeah, it just seemed like iPad came out way later. No, it didn't.
Yeah.
Got it rather quick.
Yep.
Okay, so real-time follow-up. Tim is right. The iPad originally shipped with a customized iPad-only version of iPhone OS dubbed 3.2. That may be what you're thinking of. There were two OSs, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Okay.
And then on September 1st, it was announced that iPad would get its own iOS 4.2 by November 2000. Oh, maybe you're right there too again. So it went from 3.2 to 4.2, and then Apple released iOS 4.2.1 to the public on November 22nd. So, yeah, so originally shipped on version 3.2 in 2010.
Okay. All
right. Right, but it was its own release, like...
Well, it was still called iPhone OS, but it was was a special iPad-only version, customized version for iPhone, sorry, iPad.
Yeah, that was sort of like the thing to do. I don't know if folks remember, but on the Android side, when they were trying to catch up to this, 3.0 Honeycomb was a tablet-only version of Android, and Google like very explicitly did not release the source code. Maybe they eventually did, but yeah. They like held it back because they did not want phone manufacturers to put Honeycomb on the on the phones, because it was like, you know, they presumably had cut scope to just make sure it could work as its own special little snowflake on tablets. And it wasn't until Android 4, what is that, Jelly Bean? Ice cream sandwich?
Yeah, Jelly Bean. Yeah,
it must be ice cream sandwich. It's probably ice cream sandwich, because I think,
So wait a minute, I had the original tablet that came out from Samsung, and it ran on the frozen yogurt one. What was that called? Froyo,
right. Yeah. They had Froyo and Gingerbread, Honeycomb as tablet only, and then I think Ice Cream Sandwich was the first combined, like recombining, phone OS and tablet OS.
Hmm.
So not all that dissimilar from iOS, where, as we were talking about it, recombining around 4.something.
Right. Huh. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Weirdness. So I had the iBeer app. It was one of the first apps I had. Or iPint, I think it was, for drinking. Like, it had the beer simulation thing on it.
Oh, where you could hold it up and it would, and the beer would actually go down.
Yeah, yeah.
Angle change, it would go down. Yep.
And it had Jared. And I had a flashlight app, actually, as well, believe it or not.
And you must have had, what was it called, Around Me?
No, I didn't have that one. I do remember it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had seen it.
Urban Spoon, that was another
Urban Spoon I had, yeah, for sure.
Yep. Mm-hmm. What else?
Do you know if anybody did any, like, looking back, where are they now, 10-year anniversary sort of things for those first million-dollar app folks? At some point, the media got wind of it. They called them the app billionaires.
App billionaires?
Portmanteau of app and millionaires. It's really hard to pronounce. But like, okay, you know, you go find, you know, the fart app person.
Oh, yeah?
And say, hey, where are they now? Do they own a yacht and live on an island in Tahiti? Or?
Well, I mean, that was Marco Arment's sort of, one of his claims to fame was that he had an early app, right? Didn't he have an app that he sold to Twitter or something like that? Or?
Are you talking about Instapaper?
Instapaper,
sold to BetaWorks and then got resold to Pinterest.
Mm.
But yeah, but that sort of thing. His is even sort of later, because I think it's like 2010-ish. I mean, like those first, like this article is talking about, like, was it Tap Tap Revenge and all these other things where, you know, those like first initial ones that really hit it big. And then 10 years later, it's like, you know, VH1's Where Are They Now sort of thing, where the artists.
Tumblr, that's what he wrote. Tumblr, not Instapaper. Tumblr.
Right, right. He was part of the early team at Tumblr.
Yeah. I wonder what happened to those guys. And there was the one app that was like the most expensive app in the world. It was like $99, or was it $999? It just was like a red, big red ruby or something like that was the icon.
Right. And see where's that person?
I'm rich. And you can show it to your friends.
Yeah.
I'm rich. Is that the one? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. I've got my Newton sitting here right here too, by the way. Yeah, lots of fun. All right, well, let's move on. Just a quick aside, has Google changed their format? Every link I'm looking at is like a little box with something in it. Have I done something to my Google? Every time I do a search, it gives me like, everything's in a box. They all look like paid links, as opposed to just having a big little page of links. Weird, eh?
I just typed in AirPlay into Google, and I get same standard. There's one box at the top with the sort of the definition.
Right.
But they've done that for a while, right, with this sort of one favorite result at the top. And then everything else is just the standard links.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell's going on. It's been like this the last couple of days I looked. Hmm. Weird.
You might also be in an A-B test of some sort, where they're trying to see if you're more engaged or if you're finding the right content.
Yes. Google, I'm not enjoying this. Make it stop. I hope you're listening. All right. So another follow-up story I had on here was about the Touch Bar, and I thought it was interesting that some schools are talking about, some ExamSoft is the name of this school or testing place, banning the MacBook Pro with Touch Bar from people being able to use exams, especially for taking the bar exam, because of the predictive text. I talked about this last week. I didn't have the right terminology for it, but as you're typing, you know, the predictive text helps you type things out, right? Like on the phone, when you have the you know, the little extra view above the keyboard that sort of suggests words as you're typing to sort of save you time. But you can do the same thing. In fact, you can write entire sentences or paragraphs using just the words that come up on the predictive text. But it's funny that, did you see you guys read this piece about them getting rid of it?
I did. It's interesting. I didn't really get a feel for why specifically the bar exam would ban it. Do you know?
It said here something about it could facilitate people cheating, mm-hmm. right? Taking the bar exam.
I guess you could pre-program stuff into the bar or something and have it, because you're probably writing.
Well, it says it will show predictive text depending on what the student is typing. Like, you know, if you're working on a terminology or something, as you start to type things, it kind of suggests words that go with what you're typing, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So maybe they may be exposing, you know, answers like, what is MVP stand for? Well, it's, you know, it's massive view controller, right? Like, you know, like it might suggest that for you, right? My MVP joke.
Yeah, I don't know enough about what the bar exam sort of entails from a computer standpoint. Like, I'm actually kind of surprised they let you use a laptop at all. I just assumed they'd be, you know, on some like green screen terminal where you can't really do much. I'm thinking way back. So the last time I took a standardized test where they had this sort of restriction, I think the hotness was the Texas Instruments, the TI-86 was like the highest model of graphing calculator they allowed on the test.
Right.
Specifically because the next model version up at the time was the TI-92, which was basically a little mini computer for its time. And I was like, oh no, because it can add in like all of these crazy programs that it becomes much easier to cheat. I assume this is the 2017 version of that.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
But again, if anybody out there has taken the bar exam, I can follow up with a hashtag ask MTJC as to what specifically is allowed and not allowed and what this is running a file. I'd love to learn more.
Yeah.
Well, I assume for the bar, I haven't taken it, of course, but I assume that it's a lot of writing. You know, you'll read sort of a case study or something, and you'll have to write an interpretation of it. I don't know. Maybe you could pre-program in certain... I don't know. Actually, I really don't know. I don't know how much value you could get out of just a touch bar for something like that. I have no idea.
But it's funny you mentioned that to think about the calculator, Jaime. When I was a kid in school, we weren't allowed to use calculators in math class at all. And then my sister was one of the first classes where she had to go and buy a scientific calculator. But I'm pretty sure for a long time we weren't allowed to use calculators in class at all. But and then flash forward, the last Apple certification test I took, I actually ran on my own laptop. I logged into an Apple website and basically it was I couldn't do anything else. Like I couldn't switch out of the window. I'm pretty sure it was browser-based, or something like that. But, you know, it just basically flashed the questions on me. It was multiple choice and like that. But I did it on my own computer. Previously, in other tests I had done before, you went to a place where they gave you the test, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was an interesting story about the fact that the touch bar is now the calculator of the 2017.
It's too useful, too helpful. Banned.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you know, it'll give them the answers, you know. By the way, I do have one of my pet peeves about the touch bar Yeah, is that when I'm in the mail app and I'm typing, and I'm a pretty sloppy typer, like I'm not a touch typer, right? So my hands aren't always in the home row. But right between the one and the two, the key right above that, or the virtual key right above that, is send, right? So a lot of times I'll be typing an email and all of a sudden it'll send in the middle of composing an email. What?
Yeah, like, that's not good.
You send a follow up email going, please ignore that, I wasn't finished typing yet.
Is that configurable? Can you move it?
Well, it I think some apps there are configurable, some not. Like, for instance, I don't use Siri on my MacBook at the office because it's like a church there. Mm-hmm. And the top where the eject button would be on a standard keyboard is where the Siri button is, right? So where actually it gets the power button. Power button on the other Macs. But so yeah, a lot of times when I'm reaching for the delete key, I hit the Siri key by mistake, and it's like, oh, did you want to enable Siri? No, thank you very much. You know, things to watch out for. So, Mark, you have a follow up story here about 32-bit apps. I thought they already didn't work.
So, yeah, so as we know, a couple of years ago, it was a couple of years ago, Apple started requiring that new submissions be compiled for 64 bits.
Right,
and at some point, they stopped taking 32-bit executables completely. But if you had a 32-bit application on the store, people could still download it and use it, no problem. Although, with iOS 10, they started adding an alert view that would pop up that would say that this app can slow down your phone, and you know the developer needs to update that, which, you know, I'm not sure that was really true that it was slowing down the phone, but whatever, it was there to let people know that this, you know, this needed to be updated. Well, apparently in the beta of 10.3 they've changed the messaging to be a little bit more harsh, saying that rather than it slowing down the device, it says that this app will not work with future versions of iOS. The developer of this app needs to update it to improve its compatibility. So it doesn't say when that's going to happen, I think the soonest it could happen is with 10.3, but it may not happen with 10.3. But at some point, it looks like 32-bit apps in the store are just going to stop working on new phones. If you have any of those out there, and I know I do, I've got a few old ones that I haven't updated in a while. It probably pays to revisit those and update them as soon as you can, just in case.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I updated Geek Squad last fall. Was I don't know what I was doing, but I might have been running a version of it. But I saw one of these earlier messages come up like this, and I thought, that's the last thing I want my customers to see, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I went through the process of figuring out how to, it was a Cocos 2D app, so I had to figure out how to get that to 64-bit, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I've basically been going through all of the apps that I want to keep on the store and updating them, simply because, also because there were bits falling off, right? So.
Yep, yep. For me, the reason I haven't updated some of my old ones is that a lot of them use XIB files and in order to get them to work with all the new size devices, it's quite a bit of work to convert them all to storyboards and put in all the auto layout to make them all self-sizing or correctly resizing. So some of them I have to admit I haven't updated, but I guess I need to get on that pretty soon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you can't make a XIB file obey size classes? I guess not, eh?
No, that's storyboards only, as far as I know. Yeah.
If you want to do it visually, that's correct. You can do stuff programmatically,
right.
But that's
sure.
It kind of defeats the purpose of having the nib to begin with.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be sort of an interesting sort of return on investment based decision for a lot of developers.
Yep.
And maybe some of it just be more like point of pride of like, oh no, that was my portfolio app. I want to make sure that I update it because I haven't in a while, you know, that sort of thing. I think it's generally going to be good for users. Not saying there's going to be people who aren't caught with like, oh no, like I love this app and it's not being updated. I think from that standpoint, you kind of have to hang on to an old device. Like that's the only reasonable option, right? And let's be honest, like as the stats that we just talked about it showing us, like, you should be hanging on to an iPad, and clearly you are, so there's an app that you love. Make sure it's installed on that iPad that you're not updating anyways, and continue on, because in other senses, like, this is generally good for users, because this will make iOS itself more efficient, right? It's not going to have to hang on to this 32-bit compatibility mode. It's quite aggressive. Like, this is the fastest transition that any company has gone through. It took Microsoft like a decade, and I think they're still not quite done in their 64-bit transition.
Really? Wow. Hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they've been doing this on the Mac for a long time. I mean, like various versions of OS, Mac OS, you get the little do not enter sign through the older apps, right? They just, all of a sudden, they just won't work. And I assume that was because they were not 64-bit, right? Is that not the case? Like, you know, as you
I think
go
there is a case like that, yeah.
Yeah, so, but they didn't, there was no warning about it. You just can't use this app. App, right, so
yeah, the user side didn't have the developer shaming that happens here, right? On iOS, it's like, this needs to be updated. It totally sucks. You should tell the developer.
Yeah, here's the phone number and here's his home address. Right,
right.
Go, knock, walk, mm-hmm. walk over, mm-hmm. knock on his door, and tell him to update his app. Right.
We've helpfully opened up a FaceTime call with him so you can berate him right now while he's in the shower, while he's asleep.
Yeah, we know where he lives. All right.
So you know, I wonder what effect on total number of apps in the App Store this will have, because you know, clearly Apple is trying to reduce the number of old abandoned apps and thereby streamline and clear up the App Store a little bit. So I wonder actually when, and probably only Apple knows this, when peak app submission was. I think we're past that point, right? To the point where the most number of apps like per week were being submitted to the iOS App Store. Do you agree that it kind of feels like we're past that point now? There was a time when iOS was really, really hot and everybody was making an app, right? And I think we're kind of past that point now. I think fewer people are just making, you know, apps for the sake of making an app. So there may have been, the most number of apps may have been submitted and put into the store a couple of years ago, whenever that was, I don't know, but a couple of years ago. So there may be a lot of these old 32-bit apps hanging around from that time frame that have just never been updated because, you know, it was someone who thought they were going to make millions with their app, put it out in the store, and, you know, it didn't happen, so they went away. So if they clear out a whole lot of those, it might clear out the total number of apps by quite a bit. I wonder about
that. That's true. Yeah, I mean, you had that whole flappy period, right, where everything was flappy this and flappy that, and
right.
They all tried to capitalize on this one guy's luck, right? So yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, as a sort of my next sort of follow up is just to sort of recap on what I talked about last week about trying out AdMob with my app, and I think I told Jaime last week that it was super simple, and it was so simple that I didn't get the ad unit in there correctly, so I had to go back in. And resubmit the app a couple of times actually because I still, even after the second time, I still didn't have it quite right. And the funny thing is that it took like less than 6 hours to get the app through the App Store and ready for sale.
Yeah, it's gotten real fast.
Yeah, so you know, and it was like, you know, and the review process took like 20 minutes. Mind you, it is a small app and there's not much going on in it, right? But it was faster for me to submit the app than it was for me to set it up and have an external beta tester. Like, I was still waiting for the beta tester review part to go through before it was ready for sale on the App Store. So, but what I wanted to talk about was that so since I had the chance to go back in and take this for a spin, and this is following up on Sean's question last week, I took the time to go in and look at Firebase Analytics. Because I mean, why not, right? Since I had to add the Firebase core into the app to use AdMob, I figured, well, why not just turn on Analytics as well? So, and my report on that is kind of strange because, you know, yeah, there's like a handful of reports. I mean, it's not a huge app, and I don't expect to have tons of downloads, but it's odd that I'm getting hits from Google Play and I'm getting Google TV, you know, so there's something wrong with their analytics collection because it's reporting, like, you know, I can understand iPad, I can understand iPhone, but I can't understand why I'm getting, you know, devices that I don't even support because it's an iOS app, right? Why they would be showing up in my AdMob or my Firebase Analytics. So it's kind of strange. Weird, eh?
That is weird.
Yeah, so we'll have to see how it plays out. I mean, over time. By the way, I've made a penny so far in a week, which I thought was really cool. It's probably more than I made on iAds in about the same amount of time, right? it's estimated that I've made a penny. They haven't really sort of qualified that yet. So
yeah, but you know, after taxes, that gets done nothing.
That's true, and I only get 70% of that penny, right?
That's right.
Or less, because it's Google, right? Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so what's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 78
of
the Morgan Just Code podcast.
Keep going,
yeah. You're our host,
okay,
Greg Hio.
Do the full role then. Go ahead.
All right.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 78 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Greg Hio. I'm your guest host for this week. I'm in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by your usual hosts out in Whitby, Ontario, Aaron Vey.
Hello there.
And also here in Toronto, Ontario, it's Tim Mitra.
How's it going?
Nice.
Oh, that was nice. That was nice.
That was good.
That was for the people in their cars. folks in their cars.
Folks.
I was telling Greg on Slack last night that I was mixing the podcast, and Jaime did actually make a point of saying for the folks driving in their cars last episode, but I don't think we really caught it.
He missed it. Yes, Jaime sends his regrets, and Mark will maybe be joining us in a minute.
Eventually.
Yep.
Longest minute ever.
Well, I was at the NS Coder meetup yesterday, and I got you at least one new subscriber.
Oh, good.
I forgot what I was saying. I said something about podcasts, and he said, oh, what do you listen to? Oh, someone, you know, like... anyway, I was like, oh, I've got the podcast to catch up with on my commute back home. And he's like, oh, what do you listen to? And then he was using Overcast, so I browsed the list, and I said, oh, more than just... So anyway, he subscribed, so...
Cool.
Got to make this an impressive episode, because he might be listening.
So far, so good.
Yep, good stuff.
About the weather? Let's talk about the weather.
So cold.
Oh, my God, the cold. Jesus.
And the snow. It snowed today. It's going to snow, I think, for the next week, so we're actually going to
talk. And how about Bruno Mars? Does he book off Super Bowl Sunday off his schedule? In case they call him?
I don't know who that is. Mars. I mean,
did you look at this forecast for Saturday? Feels like minus 28.
Stop that.
Unbelievable.
That's what my wife said. I don't have to go outside on Saturday.
Minus 28. You know what that is in Fahrenheit? Because I need to practice. Minus 18, which doesn't sound as bad. But Celsius minus... unbelievable. Saturday.
Minus 18?
Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
But yeah, and a bunch of snow, which is nice because we haven't really had snow, have we?
I was fine with that.
Yeah, so, well, I don't shovel snow anymore, so I don't really care either way, but...
Yeah, I do, and
it's nice. It's nice to look at.
You get to pay those condo fees. So how long have you lived in the condo?
6 years, I think. 5 years? 6 years, I think.
Where were you before that?
I lived out in High Park.
Interesting.
Yep.
Okay, so Greg, what are we talking about?
I think we got a little bit of follow-up, Tim.
All right, what are we following
up on? You, Tim.
What do you have to tell us?
This is from you, actually.
I was going to go down to yours about the app stores and economy.
Oh, you know, you probably should look at that. Why don't we do yours first, and I'll just quickly breathe through this one.
Sure. Last week, or maybe the week before, or maybe the episode before that, there was some talk about Parse shutting down.
Keep track. It was last week.
Who the heck knows? And there was much gnashing of teeth about the news, and people were saying, oh, we're doomed, and then the usual articles about you should never rely on third parties, et cetera, et cetera.
That's true. That is all true.
Yes. That's why I'm repeating it. Okay. But, of course, the Parse server is going to be open sourced, at least, and so... Folks can always go and run it on their own servers, and it's going to be an open source product. And maybe minor conflict of interest. I do know some of the Parse people, and I know they're very committed to the product. Some of them are very sad, et cetera, et cetera.
Some of them are very out of work. Is that right?
I believe they will just be moved around, but I have no knowledge about that. But I think that sort of the core product, you know, Parse server being open sourced, and there's so much interest in it because I think a lot of people the service was nice, but I think a lot of people really did like the Parse API. So they'll be able to run that on your own servers. And of course, a whole bunch of companies are now going to be starting up and offering Parse as a service or whatnot. But again, to avoid running into the same problem, I would say you should run it yourself on your own server. And it's going to be a thriving open source project, I think, coming up. And so there's this post by Fosco Morado, who's the developer advocate at Parse. And he just had this post about sort of what's going on with the open source stuff and what's coming up, and they're still going to be working on it. So anyone who likes Parse and uses it, you know, there's the migration tool and you can host it yourself, and it should be a pretty good transition as transitions go, I think.
This is like the most exciting part about Parse dying, I think, that we ended up with this server, right?
Exactly.
What I thought was interesting about the article and what I got out of it was that the rolling out of this open source version of Parse and the shutting down of Parse weren't one and the same thing. Like according to what this guy says in his article, that he was actually all set to release the open source version of Parse and wasn't aware that they were going to shut it down on the same day. And
yeah,
so he kind of pushed all the buttons to make it happen, make it go live, and then found out the news, right? So just to say that it's not coincidental that they're happening at the same time. I guess that is coincidental.
It is apparently coincidental.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. They weren't part of the same plan, as it were, right?
Yes, I don't think the people working on the open source were saying, we have to do this because it's going to be shutting down, understanding that I got from it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry.
And yet someone over their heads must have known that it was coming and thought that it was a good way to soften the blow on what they considered at the time an inevitable decision to shut down the whole service.
Yeah, but I kind of wonder, though, is like companies like Facebook, I mean, Facebook must be quite big by now in terms of executives top down to the bottom decisions, right? And sometimes, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, you know?
But, you know, this server announcement was part of their notice that the service is shutting down.
Oh, yeah? Was it? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. yeah, like they say, yeah, you've got a year and, you know, we've got two tools to help you out. One is the migrator to get you from Parse to an instance of MongoDB, and another is Parse Server. And Parse Server, not coincidentally, works with MongoDB as its back-end data source. So, you know, like somebody over Fosco Morado's head knew about this and planned accordingly. That's my theory. That's my read of this.
Mm.
So, but it's great. I mean, and I think what Greg is saying is absolutely true. You know, this could lead to a thriving, you know, tool set for mobile developers, you know, who are already familiar with the Parse API. And, you know, although I've never studied it myself, having never believed in using a service like this for reasons that we've discussed, now it seems worthwhile to take a look at. And everyone seems to like it. Those that use it. Mm-hmm. Those that use it love it. And everyone else just stayed the hell away because they were smart. Parse 2 for the win. We're all over that. Let's see that happen. I want to try it out, actually. I've got a little toy project that I'm working on right now, and I'm actually considering using this.
How's your node and how's your express, Aaron?
Terrible. You need to debug non-existent. Oh, yeah? Yeah, but this is going to make me try and figure it out. What the hell? I've got a server. I'll give it a shot. Mm-hmm. Why not? I mean, why not?
Got that's the server sitting there. Yeah, for sure.
I was hoping to have, like, five picks to outdo Jaime from last episode. and just come up with pick after pick after pick. But I do not have that. But I have a pick. I'll go ahead with it. It's an app called Hirundo. I don't know how to pronounce it. The subtitle is Comfortably Follow Swift Discussions.
This so if you're is on crazy.
If you're on any of the Swift mailing lists, Swift Evolution, the core libraries discussion and whatnot, and you're getting the emails, you're probably using some kind of filter rule to put them into a folder and follow the threads. If you get the digest like I do, that's even worse because you get the digest at seemingly random times during the day and you just have to find message number 7 and scroll down and whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's not that great. So there's this app that I think scrapes the website that hosts the mailing list archives, and you download this app and you pick which list you want, and it shows you, it's almost like it's like a mail client or a newsreader client, if anybody out there, folks out there are as old as we are and know what that is, but imagine like a mail client that is just for the mailing list, and you don't have to actually answer any email or, you know, receive email. So it just reads the things, does all the threading for you. You can browse by person, browse by topic, browse by thread, and whatever. So if you want to browse through the mailing list or you want to go back and find something that you saw mentioned, then this is the app to do it. It's in beta, and it is free.
It is astonishing, really, for something so niche, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's almost like a single-serving website in a way.
Yeah.
But it is so, it's lovely and full-featured. I can't get my mind around why the developer, Benedict Terhecht, did this. You know? Just blows my mind.
Yeah, I'm sure it was just like, I want to browse these mailing lists, and I don't want to click through the horrible Piper Mail archive,
really,
and I don't want to use my own mail client, so let's just do it here.
Let's just do this.
The app is still in beta. It has crashed on me a couple of times, sometimes when I scroll, but you know, you want to browse through, this is the way to do it.
And it turns out the name Hirundo is Latin for swift. So it's not for nothing.
As in the bird or quick?
As in quick.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Don't you know your Latin?
I studied Latin. I thought I knew my Latin, but I had never heard that before.
Amamus, amamus, amunt, or whatever, something like that.
Not bad.
I was going to do the Greek the farmer declension, but let's skip that.
A what?
You know, Agricola, Agricolae, Agricolam, whatever it is. Isn't that the word everyone uses?
No, it was farmer, never the word
because
I used.
It is a masculine word, farmer, but it's in the first declension, ends in the A, you know, so it's kind of an oddball. All right, enough Latin. Forget about it. So Swift in Latin. Hirundo, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my pick. Check it out if you want to.
This is what happens when Canadians run a podcast.
Read through the mailing lists.
You had any good poutine lately?
I had some tonight.
I just went to Smokes. I went to Smokes the other day.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't like Smokes.
You've never been there. You don't like it?
No, it's a little too out there for me. Too heavy. I feel a little ill after having that their poutine.
Well, as you should after all good poutine. But
no.
It was on the way home. I was like super hungry, and I was like, oh, I could go for some poutine.
So you and I both had poutine with our dinner tonight?
No, it was
That was yesterday.
I think it was yesterday.
All right.
Yeah, not
I
today.
Had some poutine.
Not today.
Tonight.
Okay.
Interesting.
It was very good.
So, I think I mentioned on the show that I've always sort of been looking for the good poutine, and I never really found a really good one. And I was out with a friend of mine. We were checking out some electronic stores over on College, and there was a place called, looking for it.
Some kind of hot dog something or other?
Frank's Gourmet Dogs, I think it was somewhere.
Frank's.
And it's gourmet hot dogs, right? I got like a Coney Island hot dog with chili on it, which was really good. It was like chili and I want to say it had sweet and sour kind of thing, right? Mustard and chili or something like that. And onions, maybe. But I also got a side, which turned out to be giant, of bacon and egg poutine.
Hello!
Yeah, and it was like, you know, fried egg, two fried eggs maybe, and then a whole bunch of chopped bacon on top of the best poutine I've ever had. You know, so.
Oh my God.
So it's like poutine breakfast.
You say this is on College?
Yeah, College. Yeah, I'm just looking for the name. It's called Frank's. I'll put it in the show notes for sure.
For all the Toronto listeners.
Yeah, for those driving in cars. Yeah, for the Toronto listeners.
For some reason, that sounds...
You know, if you're going to come to Ennis North, there's another reason.
Oh.
You should go over to Frank's on College and have bacon and egg poutine. You have no excuse now.
Right? All right, that sounds good. Tim, did you have another pick than this one? Is that...
No, I had no pick. I was going to be like Mark and be like, oh, I don't have a pick.
Yeah, and I was going to, like I said, I was going to be high man and have five picks, but...
Alas.
Can't always get what we want.
No, nope. You cannot. like some kind of
and scene.
Thanks.
Like an animal.
I actually waved when I say goodbye there. That's kind of my
did you? Oh.
Do you say that?
I did.
I do that sometimes. When I say bye to people on the phone,
did you wave? Did you wave by wiggling your wrist, or did you get the whole arm into there?
The whole arm. I was like back and forth. Oh, not like the queen, baby. I was like, you know, full on wave, like Pee Wee
Herman.
Wow. Cool.
Wow.
All right, I'm coming.
I usually do that when I'm talking on the phone.
Probably. Yeah, so I guess we should wait for Mark to arrive before we discuss your visit with the Dr. Rubin.
It was a very good visit. We talked about all of Aaron's favorite topics, the weather, hockey, San Jose Sharks, the Patriots, the Super Bowl.
You're killing me.
Yeah, he would have. Aaron would have loved it.
Wow, so what's Mark like in person?
He's very, very talkative. Very
really?
Talkative.
Shut
up. Not a thing. I'm serious. He's like super talkative.
Wow.
And, yeah.
We must catch him at a bad time of day. That's all I can think of. It's like, you know, 6 o'clock and he's like, I've just worked a full day. I should probably still be working and I can't believe I'm here.
Well, I mean, sometimes when you guys get him going, he's like, you know,
yeah,
you go. But he's like, yeah, I guess we went for lunch. So it was during the, it was like noon, you know, but yeah, no, still, he is very friendly and yes, very talkative.
Well, and sort of, like I said, he was sort of the inspiration for starting up this podcast. Neither one of us, neither he or I were into podcasts at all before when we started, but and he still isn't, right? But yeah, you know, in all the times I ever did any sort of work with him, you know, like I said, I would work for you know, a couple of minutes and then it would be like hours of conversation, right?
Wow, I gotta tell you, that's a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm. He's very, very knowledgeable about the code too, which he doesn't
That I'm certain.
Yeah.
Oh, he showed off two or three of his apps that he was working on, like the previous one and the couple that he was working on.
Cool.
So yeah, we also talked about core data and I don't know, view controller transitions, and you know, there was code. It wasn't just more than just the code. We talked about the code too, so it's nice. He didn't make me code on the whiteboard, so that was a refreshing change.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Him though, another concert, unbelievable.
He doesn't go to that many concerts.
He has missed two recordings because of concerts in the last 3-4 months. I forget how long. So yeah, he goes to a lot of that's a fair amount. That's just the Wednesday concerts too, right? There could be concerts on other days that we've never heard about.
Well, that's true. Mm-hmm. I just went to a concert last Saturday up in Redwood City. Not
oh yeah,
too far.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you used to live right by there, Greg. Right?
I used to live in Redwood City. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
This was. Did you ever go downtown to downtown Redwood City at all?
I did, yeah. I liked it. It was nice.
You know the Fox Theater there?
No, although I do remember passing a theater. I don't remember the name of it, but maybe I know.
Yeah, it's one of these old, you know, it used to be a movie theater way back when that's converted over to a concert.
Yeah, yeah.
Event. Yeah, yeah. So I saw Buckethead there. We were talking about this last week.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. That didn't make it onto the show. That was definitely post show.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I don't know who that is. I'd have to Google it.
It's he's out there. He's different. He's a guitarist that...
Oh, he actually has a bucket on his head.
Yeah. He's a phenomenal, I mean phenomenal guitarist. I mean, he's possibly the top five guitarists ever, just in terms of skill. I mean, he's just unbelievably skilled, but he's insane.
Does he wear a mask?
Yeah, he wears a mask.
Okay.
And the bucket used to be, he actually got a new bucket for this tour. It used to be just a Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket that he'd wear.
Yes.
Now he just got a nice plain minimalist white bucket that he's wearing.
Oh, okay. But, okay. With the lighting, I thought it was a pink bucket is what it looks like, but maybe
that's just the lighting.
It's the stage lighting.
It
okay.
It was just a white. And he plays sort of, it's sort of a mix of metal.
The Wikipedia page says it spans diverse areas such as progressive metal, funk, blues, jazz, bluegrass, ambient, and avant-garde.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. It's just everything. He can play anything and he does, you know, he plays anything and everything. It's just amazing. So I recommend it if he ever comes. Actually, I think he's playing at...
Is he on Spotify? I'll go look him up.
I'm sure he is.
Okay.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah. Look it up.
He has... Did you notice this in Wikipedia? He has 250 approximately albums out.
I saw a number.
That's
really? 264 studio. I know this 260 because I thought of H264 and I thought, 264 studio albums. I wonder how many of them are on Spotify.
Gotta be a few of them.
Not all 264.
No, probably
maybe
not.
They have a limit.
So that's my post-show pick of the week.
All right, I'm going to check it out. And if you also look at the Wikipedia page, they have the only known photograph of him without his mask, if you're curious. Of course, it's kind of a backside picture, so it's not very good. Yeah. But
I've actually seen him without the mask.
You've seen him without the mask?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's not performing. He always wears it when he's performing. But I actually saw him, this was almost 20 years ago now, do a solo show down in Santa Barbara when I lived down there at this tiny, tiny little club. I mean, there couldn't have been more than 30 or 40 people in the club. And it was an all-acoustic set, which was, you know, for him, very unusual because he's usually really loud and you know, very, very high energy. But this was a one-off thing of he just played all acoustic. And so he just showed up at the club and with his amp and a guitar. And he's there before the show. He's just there setting up his equipment without the mask on. And he just looked like a regular guy. I mean, he really was just a regular guy. Then he went behind stage, came back out with the mask and the hat, and he was bucking it. Complete transformation. But you could tell it was him because he's got a very unusual shape in that he's very tall and thin and has, you know, really long fingers and stuff. I mean, very kind of spiderish sort of almost. So it was clearly recognizable as him.
All right. He is on Spotify. But there are maybe 50, I didn't count them, but there may be like 50 records are on here.
Well,
so,
you know, if you like that style of music and you kind of won't know until you try it, then you'll really like him. He's not everybody's cup of tea. I have to be honest about that.
Okay.
If you like stuff like Primus, you know, Les Claypool, mm-hmm. I don't know if these ring any bells. If you like that kind of stuff, then you'll probably like him. He was in a band once called Guns N' Roses. You ever heard of them? he really was. I mean, this is after they were really big. He joined them after Slash, who I guess was the first guitarist. Mm-hmm. He left and they needed a replacement for him. So he joined for a couple of years to tour. I mean, he plays some, you know, relatively accessible stuff, but a lot of his stuff is pretty out there.
All right. I'm curious now. Mostly curious about to get into the mind of Dr. Rubin, see what kind of music he listens to. I'm going to check it out.
I listen to a lot of different music, so that could take a long time.
All right. Tim just checked in with me on Slack saying, did you guys start later? And I was like, oh, how did he know? I just told him we were wrapping up, and yes, we started an hour later. So
tell him we started at a civilized West Coast
I was
time.
Just going to say, I didn't have to rush. I did rush home anyway, just in case, but I didn't have to rush home. I rushed home, and I still, maybe I'll eat something. I can, you know, go collect the mail and go through it. So it was nice. It was nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you hand Tammy the mic, then I think it's almost time to wrap up.
Are
and of course,
pick?
It wouldn't. No, we're not doing picks.
Oh,
don't worry.
Come on.
But it wouldn't be
pick,
an
though.
Episode of More Than Just Code Roundabout release notes unless we entered. And I got the key if we entered the chaotic studio.
Oh, okay.
So Tammy, I have a series of questions. If we could do it rapid fire, if you please.
Wait, you're going to ask me?
So Tammy, what is your favorite?
Revenge is a meal best served cold.
Tammy herself has noted that she has answered these questions on the website, but we can all check and make sure. She doesn't have her phone with her. So, Tammy, what is your favorite color?
When am I allowed to change my answers? I've grown as a person today.
Exactly.
So my answers might change.
Okay. Favorite color?
Black.
What is your least favorite color?
Oh, goodness. Pink.
Yep. Popular answer. What is your favorite word?
I'm going to apologize right now, but my favorite word is fuck.
We're going to have to mark this episode as explicit now. Tim, what is your least favorite word?
Not puck.
The Chaotic Studio. Who knew? What do you hate most? Your biggest pet peeve?
People being told that they can't do something. Not the people who are being told that, but the people who are saying that to the people. I just want to throat punch anyone who says, you can't do it.
We had people driving their car home in the cars and throat punching. I think we've hit all of the memes here. Who is your favorite fictional character?
That is a tough one because I have so many favorite fictional characters. Let me think. See, this is where editing comes in, because that long pause, I edited it out in Roundabout. So I'm just going to, off the cuff, because Captain Picard.
I'm doing the Picard facepalm right now for those those driving at home. Who is your role model?
Again, I have so many. My mom is my role model for one on the life side of things, because she raised two kids on her own. My dad wasn't able to be there, so she was very strong in my life. My husband, who's sitting in the back room, he's another role model, because he was the one who said, "Look, I love you how you are," which kind of messed up, but I still love you. So he taught me unconditional love. So he's my role model for that. And Simon, you're back there. You're my role model for developers.
What is your biggest dream?
To be like Simon. No, I'm just kidding. My biggest dream is to get on a plane and not be afraid and travel the world and hopefully have my family come along with me. That would be nice.
Starting with Ireland, right?
Yes, I'll be in Ireland speaking at Yule. I got it. Yule.
What is your greatest achievement?
As of right now, not counting my kids and staying married for almost 19, we've been married a long time. Sorry, honey. this conference right now, I mean, 10 months ago, Indie DevStock, 10 months ago, it wasn't even a blip on the radar. So yeah, right now.
What do you regret the most?
This conference.
I should have seen that one coming. If you could choose another profession, what would it be? And don't say conference organizer.
I think if I could choose another profession, it would be being a professional artist. I suffer greatly from imposter syndrome, and people tell me that, you know, your work is really good, but I see people... Will Terry is a really good friend of mine. He's a children's book illustrator, and to me, that's a professional artist. He's so good. Go get his stuff. So that would be the other career for me.
And the most important question, what would you do in a zombie apocalypse?
Survive at all costs. And one of the reasons I put that question in my show was so I can help to build my zombie apocalypse army. So if you're on the show and you answer that question correctly, you'll be in the army. You can come to Tennessee. We got the bunker. We'll hang out when the virus clears out, because I'm pretty sure it's going to be a virus that starts it. It's probably going to be one of my jerk friends or family that actually kicks it off. But yeah, that's what I would do, survive. And you can't, it doesn't matter if it's fast zombies or slow zombies or a tornado or a house fire. You just kind of do whatever you have to do to survive. But you have to understand that you still need to be a human being at the end of the day. I don't mean to sound cliche and bumper stickery, but yeah, if you're not a really good person, it's not going to matter if you survive, because everyone will leave you. So you need to not only keep yourself safe, but the people you love.
I'd get that on the bumper sticker.
Yeah. I don't know how you're going to fit it. Like 2-point font.
I'd find a way to condense it. All right. Well, it's always my job to keep things on time. Shorter shows, right, Tim? Tim is nodding. So
hey, Greg, if people want to look for you on the internet, where would they find you?
They should go to Twitter. I'm at Greg Heo, GREGHEO.
And Tammy, if people want to find you on the interweb?
I am Paradox927, and you can also find me pretty much anywhere. I'm here.
And Jaime?
I am also on Twitter as at Dev with the Hair.
Joe?
I'm at Twitter at jchplinski, CIEPLINSKI.
And as usual, my name is Tim Mitra. I'm TIMMITRA on Twitter, and we'll see you guys next week, or next time, I guess.
And we'll all say goodbye now.
All right, bye.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/mtjc. You can find out details on how to help us out on the website, mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Now stick around for the after show, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, and send selfies if you find these guys. We have selfies for our Facebook page.
Oh, that's right. It's been a while. When was the last selfie that you posted?
We posted the one with Jonathan and Xavier, just as a matter of fact.
With the t-shirts, that's right.
And I think I didn't get a full, you know, smiley face a selfie from Jaime. He said he owes me one. He sent a picture of the shirt on his torso, but yeah, it's kind of decapitated there.
Yeah, and just to clarify for people, that would be selfies where Mark and Greg know that they are in the selfie. Please don't do a selfie of yourself with them in the background as a candid. They're like scarfing down breakfast burritos or something.
Hey, no, we're not proud. We'll take any selfie you want to send us.
Tim's not picky with what he posts on the Facebook page.
So yeah, if you're in the stall, you know, at the urinal, you know, feel free to.
If I see somebody with a MTJC t-shirt or a MTJC sticker on the computer, I will take a stealth selfie with them.
Sure, all right. And don't forget, like, if you get a black eye from one of these two guys, you know, send us a selfie of that, too.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.